Excuse me, I'm just going to put my metadata on here. This is Roger Layton at the Saudi conference, 27th of February to 1st of March 2013 at WITS University. Now, I put that down because 10 years' time I'm going to look at all these audio files and think to myself, what was this one? Where did it come from? If it just starts as talks. I need the microphone here. If we can get the microphone. Rewind. No, this one doesn't have a rewind. It's not one of those expensive jobs because we can't afford those. No. Okay, let's start again. Okay, let me just try and get this attached to me. I'm going to do this with my pen's falling down now. And I'll put that here. See if I can clip that on there. Good. Can you hear me now? Okay. Rewind. My name's Roger Layton, and I'm, even though this is a digitization conference, I've noticed that there is a bit of a lack of digitization of the proceedings, and I'm busy recording my own, and what I started off doing was just recording my name, the conference, other things, so that when I listen back to the item later, the first thing I'll hear on it is, where did this come from? It's audio metadata, that's all it is. I'm going to talk about something called Towards the Digital Institution. And I'm going to try and refer back to what other people have said as well during this time. And I'm going to try out my little unit and see if this actually works. Does this actually work? It doesn't work. Okay, so that means I've got to walk over here and press the button to move on to the next. No, it's okay. I need the walk. I need the exercise. Okay. So the first point I'm making is that digitization is not just the process of capture, storage. It is a much, much wider process, and it impacts the entire institution. Now, one of the largest things that we've done over the past few years is develop the national policy, and we tried to frame that national policy into the very broadest definition of what digitization is as the emergence of a digital culture, and not just the capturing of your archives, the storage of them, and the discussions about whether PDF or JPEG was the right idea. And when we went into this, I will admit, we really didn't have a clue as to what a policy is or how this worked. We knew what we were doing. We were IT specialists, and I was very glad we got the job. But the breadth of this was quite incredible. We had to look at what people's initiatives were and what people's goals were in getting to this particular point. And when we looked at Michelle's paper from Acadla One, right at the end of that was a few points to say, when a national policy comes out, here's some of the things it should do. And that gave us a starting point for what the thinking was. I believe this is a fundamental responsibility of our generation. It cannot be delegated to anybody else. This is ours. And we've got to pass something on to the next generation of future custodians of what we've done. I believe this requires a 20 to 500-year envisioning environment, which is rather difficult to look that far into the future. We've got the distinct benefit there won't be anybody there to tell us whether we did a good job or a bad job. But this transition impacts on three things that I'm going to look at. So my paper today is on three particular things. How does it impact the user experience? How does it impact on your collection management? And how does it impact on the governance of institutions? And I've taken those three from the accreditation scheme in the UK on how museums are accredited. And I believe they're three very good and logical structures in which to envision the impact of digitization. The skill to ensure success are multifaceted. It's just been said now that we computer scientists might have a role to play, so I'm feeling a little bit more welcome. I'm presenting this, and I'm saying some of the things that we're doing. I am also introducing, in the context of this, some of the things we're doing in the development of products and services. Under normal conditions, I'd never stand up and give a sales pitch or anything. I really want to share with you what it is. But I do believe that some of the things we're doing, I'd like to share with you and see if what you're doing might help. Now, let's move on to the next one. And what I want to do first is take us back to what we're doing right now is changing our method of recording. That's effectively what it is. We're moving from the physical to the digital. I'd like us to move back to around about 20,000 BC first, where the first evidence of symbols in rock art in particular, existed. Writing, first writing evidence, 3000 BC, moving up to bookshops, but handwritten bookshops, copying of books in Baghdad around 800 AD, the printing press, electronic computers, moving on to where we are now, where everything is digital. Every person with a mobile phone is recording digital content, pushing it up to Facebook, and they're publishing it. So this is where we are now. We've really lost a lot of control over this, and we've lost control over authenticity. And this is why I quite like the first talk on trusted repositories, because what distinguishes what's happening here from the rest of the digital world is authenticity and trust. That's why this is distinguished. Now, what I wanted to do is not just move back in time, but move forward in time as well. And as part of the process of developing the policy, we used a number of research tools, quantitative tools, qualitative. We did literature surveys, but we also did a scenario analysis where we tried to project ourselves into the future. Now, I'm not really talking so much about the policy here. I'm presuming some of you have read it. It's downloadable. It's on the DAC website. Just type into Google National Policy on Digitization, and you can get a copy of it as it was published 2 years ago. But one of our methods was this method of scenario planning, moving into the future and trying to understand where we are. So part of that is I started to look 5 years into the future. And that's a very dangerous part to look into the future, because I'm still going to be around for people to criticize whether I was right or not. And I've called this the birth of the digital institution. I presented this at one of the very early papers I presented at the SASA conference in 2009, where I projected some of these scenarios. And at this particular point, I talked about information society gaining momentum, the birth of this, not much more. Now let's look 20 to 50 years into the future. And here are some of the assumptions I'm making. All new records are born digital. The Internet of Things is the largest producer of data. Has anybody heard of the Internet of Things? Okay. This is where we currently are the users of the Internet. What if the users of the Internet were things now? Our fridges, our archives themselves. In fact, every piece of paper is an intelligent and addressable thing on the Internet. The assumption is that is where the greatest producer of content is going to be moving into the future. The information society is universal. Every single person does have access to the Internet all time, very high bandwidth. All pre-existing records by this time in the 50 horizon would have been digitized. We're moving into time capsule storage systems, where in order to preserve things for the future, we're taking time capsule very seriously and depositing them to be opened up at a certain point in time. Have any of you got time capsules? Have any of you thought about time capsules? There is a time capsule society. I suggest you have a look at that. I also believe in the 50-year horizon, XML will still be the predominant language for management. Now let's move it to 200 to 500 years into the future, where now I can say what I want. Nobody can possibly come along and say anything. But intelligent agents gather and preserve information. I believe repositories at this point are protected against every form of disaster. And in particular, we need to build in the inherent capability for some future society to reboot all of humanity's knowledge at any point in time. Previous societies never did this. That's why we've lost the knowledge of how the Incas built their stonework, how the pyramids were built. We've lost all of this. But can we build this in so that sometime in the future, after going through another dark ages, society could reboot itself? Also looking at holographic and quantum storage systems. Here I can make up whatever I want to, because nobody is going to talk about it. I haven't got a clue what's going to happen here. I haven't got a clue what's going to happen here. And in fact, I'm only just guessing at what's going to happen in the next 2 months. This is all we know about IT. So where we are right now in transitioning, we're at a certain point in time where our need for physical records is reducing and our need to manage digital records is increasing. So, I want to talk about the nature of this transition now. It's our generation's responsibility to get this right. I believe this transition should take place within 20 years. And my philosophy today and my approach is to create the digital institution. Okay, I made a spelling mistake. It's funny, you only notice the spelling mistakes when you're standing right in front of it. But this requires a total re-engineering of the institution. This is not just let's build a digitization thing. We've now got to re-engineer everything from the beginning. What has to be done? I believe capacity development is the fundamental. There has been this issue between outsourcing. Do you do it yourself? The approach that I'm taking and the approach that we're adopting is that this is so core to what you're doing that this is your core function, is to move your institution into the digital world, and this should only be outsourced to gain experience. You've got to build capacity yourself, and that's the approach we're taking. It is the core skill of the memory institutions. It shouldn't be outsourced unless there are things you can't do. For example, digitizing newspapers might require specialist equipment you don't have. So let's talk about what it is that you're digitizing. And when we looked at the policy on digitization, even though the people closest to us was the National Archives, the National Library, and some of the other institutions, we wanted to broaden the scope to cover anything to do with any type of knowledge or whatever. So tangible, the objects in museums, archaeological sites, the sites themselves being digitized. During the course of this work, we attended a very interesting workshop and conference in Cyprus on 3D modeling of archaeological sites and buildings. We found that quite interesting. The oral history, indigenous knowledge, the living heritage, those are supposed to be scratched out there. That was a mistake on the slide. This one doesn't work. Okay. The documentary heritage, libraries and archives, also the born digital. I haven't seen much discussion here on what do you do with the email archives that are coming in that you've got to look after. Because whereas people used to write to each other a few years ago, nobody writes to each other anymore. You send emails. That is your next generation of documentary heritage, and you've got to find a solution for how you deal with that. Because right now, otherwise, there's going to be a massive gap in the knowledge, in the storage. Your administrative records as well. But then also knowledge. It was so interesting to hear the discussion on geological data sets yesterday. Because we've looked at this as being also fundamental to digitization, is how do you deal with those scientific data sets? The knowledge of science, biology, mathematics, everything in that particular area. So this is it. The point that I've been looking at, and why this has become a computer problem, is that once these have come down, they all effectively files, they all start to look the same. So we can develop a single digital heritage that encompasses everybody's differences. Now, I had wanted to mention a couple of things here, which I think I'll mention at this point before I go into detail. Europeana has been mentioned. Is anybody familiar with Europeana and what it's doing? I've noticed that there was a brochure sitting out here there on Europeana called Europeana Connect. Who dropped that brochure there? You did. Okay. We are part of another Europeana consortium called Europeana Inside, which is not run under the FP7, it's run under another program. We're the only, as far as I know, African organization to be involved. And this is to build a body of knowledge and practice on how to connect to Europeana, with the intention that hopefully we can bring that practice into an Africana. Africana doesn't really sound right, but the body of all digital libraries shared together as a single resource. And so it was very nice to be invited into that. Following up on two other things before I go in here, in the policy, if you've read it, there are two policies which make sense here. One of them is the policy number one on digitization strategy, which helps to define what it is and how you get there, and I've noticed discussions on that. But policy number 22, particularly want to mention, was to develop a community of practice called the Institute for Digital Heritage. And I believe this is it, okay? In other words, instead of waiting for the rest, I believe that we've actually achieved one of those policy statements before the policy is ratified. And I'd like, when we get into the discussions this afternoon, I'm quite happy to share with you what our thoughts were. And the reason is that a huge amount of that information was taken out of the policy before it was published because it was too detailed. And now let me take you on to this then. Where we got to was a series of 27 statements, policy statements, which then led to the mechanisms. One of those mechanisms was the Institute for Digital Heritage. It was a professional body. Currently, SADI is not constituted at all. You don't have a constitution, you don't have a board of directors, you don't have anything. But yet what we proposed here was a very strong professional body that had very particular responsibilities and would have funding as well. And I'd like to hopefully put that on the table as a shared thing. Then we had the digital heritage body of knowledge, which we're still busy with. I'd like to share this with other people. I'd like to say, look what we've done so far. It is intended to be a community responsibility. It's not intended to be just us alone, but we've held on to it because I don't know who to give it to. So I'd very much like to look at that as well and see how we can move on from that particular point. Now, what we did, and I'm just going to introduce this as the part of the introduction to the three points I want to make. What does the Digital Heritage Framework look like? A set of principles. At the ACADLA conference 2011, I spoke about what the principles were. It also introduces who the participants are, a 10-process model that fits in, the practices on how to do detailed things, such as the digitization of glass slides and negatives, the problem areas, and then the products that come out of it. And this was what we called the Digital Heritage Body of Knowledge. And in particular, the 10-process model for digitization attempt, and this was mentioned in the policy, is the intention to capture the things that need to be done for a successful digitization. Starting off with custodian responsibilities and scoping. This is what very much what Michelle and Charles have just talked about now. You've got to know where you are. Then how do you strategize? How are you going to get there? Project planning, project management is an essential skill in this. Moving on to what we call preparing, capturing, describing, loading, storing, accessing, and using. And after quite a considerable amount of thought, we came up with these 10 processes, which we believe encompass not only the practice, but also the disputes and the discussions and the discourses that were taking place in digitization as of 2009 when we wrote this. So I believe that these are still current, and at least they're a starting point for discussion on how to move further. So in the light of that, I then looked at how do you transition yourself into the digital institution on the assumption that at some time in the future, and if we look at the wide spectrum for 20 years back to 20 years into the future, don't look now from yesterday to today or last year to next year. Look at a 20 to 40 to 50 year horizon. Extend your work from where you were 20 years ago up to now and 20 years into the future. These are the things I believe you should be looking at. How do you govern yourself? How do you manage your collections, and how do you improve the experience to users? I'm going to take you through each one of these. On the one side here, for example, here we've got the people involved. Here we've got here the kind of things that are happening. For example, under collection management, all the ICA standards that have just been mentioned here, the spectrum procedures for museum management. Under the governance, you need constitution. Up here, you need websites, mobile sites, even Google Glasses very soon into the future as well. So I'm going to take you through those three now. And this will be the end of my talk. So the transitioning of governance. The first question is, how does governance change in terms of a digital world? I suggest you've got to review all of your governance structures, and you've got to think, how does governance change in the light of being a digital institution? One statement of purpose. I'm presuming you've all got something called a statement of purpose or mission or values or vision or something. Why does it exist, and who is it for? Now, I've said the word museum, but effectively any memory institution could be encompassed there. Here's the thing. You could increase your user base by a factor of 10 to 100 to 1,000 by doing this properly. And this is the vision statement. There's no limit to the reach in the digital world, but there's a massive limit to the reach if you're purely physical. Some of the people we're dealing with are small museums that have only got a physical presence. Constitution. Change your constitution. Include a 15-year-old onto your board of directors. Okay? They know a lot more than I do about how to use a mobile phone. They're in touch with what happens. They're your audience. That's who you've got to include. I'm quite unhappy when I go to meet a board of directors and they all look like me. It's very depressing. Clarify the purposes and objects in the light of the digital age, and also make management arrangements to make sure that managers and staff are fully conversant with all digital technologies. If you cannot, then train them or replace them. There's no excuse for non-literate people in the senior management of organizations at this point. Have a comprehensive digitization strategy. Policy number one said, every institution should have a digitization strategy. It put minimum requirements and said you've only got one requirement, and that is to publish it for public view. That is it. Now we can debate on whether your digitization strategy is good or bad, but there was no enforcement of what it should be. It just says you should be. I was saying 2 years ago that that digitization strategy could say we don't digitize. But now I can't say that anymore. It is inexcusable. You have to digitize right now. Your premises for holdings should include where your digital holdings are stored. In other words, in the constitution, the governance statement of any body, you should really be saying, Are your premises secure, where you keep your archives? Now, most of you are from universities. It is secure for a very long time. But for many of the smaller archives, specialist archives, libraries, there's no guarantee that these are held. Question is, how secure are your digital holdings? Where are they? Are they on a hard drive? Are they on a DVD? Are they in the cloud somewhere? Where are they? Because if you don't know where they are, that is a very serious government governance limitation. So you must know where they are. They must be under total control. Tell you what we're doing right now at a little museum called the Winterton Museum in KwaZulu-Natal. We've just established a relationship with them. They've got collections of local history, battlefields, rock art. They're board part-time local members, including two rather elderly farmers who've never used a mobile phone in their life. Okay. Website, nothing. Digitization projects, nothing. So we are offering them something. In fact, this is reason I mention this is a complete pro bono thing. We're just doing it because I've got a house in the area and I want to help the community. What are we doing? We're going to help to create a representative board. We're going to train them. We're going to build their website. We're going to also put their website onto mobile phones so tourists can access it. We're going to create a digitization strategy. We're going to try and find funding for them, and we're going to build up an electronic inventory. So now their governance process is changing because I'm providing a bit of an intervention there. Let's have a look at the second one. Collection management. How do you transition this? Well, everybody has a collection development policy. It effectively says, what do you acquire, what do you dispose of? But now you've got to consider, how does your acquisitions and your disposals happen in the light of born digital collections and the provenance records associated with those digital collections? And this is a big challenge, and I don't believe we're close to solving this right now. I think you've now got to look, and maybe collectively, what is the provenance of digital records that are born digital? Collections information policy says build up database inventories. We use Spectrum quite extensively in the museum world, but I haven't seen many actual museums here. You're mainly libraries and archives. Collection care policy, how do you perform digital care preservation reformatting? Fortunately, I look back in the policy when that issue was raised earlier about digital preservation policies, and we just mentioned two things, that there should be format watching, format succession planning, and that should be effectively a national initiative to do that. And the digitization of the collections, programs and projects to build them up. And as was mentioned in the previous talk, the prioritization of this is a difficult question. The selection process is a difficult question. There are no answers to this. So that's the how the institution can change in this light. I'll give you a couple of examples here. One of them is with the Ananda Seminary in KwaZulu-Natal, a very old girls' school, of which they host around about 50 years of archival history, and the rest is held at the Killie Campbell collection. We're only looking at the 50 years here of the archives that they've got. We're currently building up a complete inventorization as a prelude to digitization, and that question came up as well, should you digitize versus inventorize later? My absolute belief is you've got to have a working inventory before you can start. It doesn't make sense, because otherwise you'll end up with digital documents. You cannot place them anywhere. They should be named, they should be identified, and you should know where they are. In our definition, an inventory is knowing what you've got, where it's stored. If you know that, you're okay. Then we're going to create a digitization collection. We've also got our collection management system. We call it Etherbase, and it is effectively probably similar to the ICA Atom or anything else like that. The next project we've got is with the Kulamani Support Group, who've got 50,000 members with many oral histories recorded, some audio, some written. We're creating a shared history, and a paper was presented. Unfortunately, I couldn't attend this conference due to a clash with another conference on what we called a shared history using digitization, where these records are not kept individually, but we looked at the interplay between them to create a group-type memory as opposed to an individual memory. And we built the system for that. We've actually spoken at two oral history conferences on this and this one as well, presenting this and further developments of this. Key thing is, using the digital record, we can create structures you cannot ever do with physical. It's not just replacing physical with digital. We can now do things you could never do before in terms of connectivity. So the final part now is transitioning the user experience. How does the users see this? Firstly, know your users. Do you know who your users are who come along? In most cases, people can't even track who their users are. You need to know who your users are. Physical access. Who walks into your archives? Do they fill a book? Do you track what they look at? This is incredibly useful information. Future, we want to find out what news is use can be gained if there's good digital access, and then create the digital door. You've got your physical door, now let's open the digital door. Digital access before, during, and after physical visits, but also in spite of physical visits. Many small museums we've spoken to are very scared that people might come onto their website and never come and visit them. And that is the wrong approach. It's got to now be that the digital approach, why you're here for is to share information. Whether people come physically or come digitally doesn't make any difference. What we've got to change is the measurement system. You've got to be measured by feet through the physical door as well as feet through the digital door. Support for mobile users and tablet users and a welcome, accessible digital environment. And also, you want to use digital access to stimulate and support learning, research, discovery. So I'm just now going to give you a couple of examples of what we're doing in this space as well. And the first one is to provide what we call a mobile web page for museums. First thing we're doing for the Winterton Museum is building them a web page that's accessible over a mobile device so that anybody in the rural areas and any tourist can find them and can learn about them. Because the brochures are expensive, they're difficult to distribute. Most people don't even find where this museum is. This is a very, very basic thing. I'm just going to tell you, these were drawn from a paper that I gave a few months ago at the SAMA conference, South African Museums Association, where my talk was on mobile access to museums. The second one takes it a bit further, what we've called the virtual guide, which is where, when you come to a place, and instead of having an information board associated with the objects that you'll see, or in a site, that you type something into your mobile phone, similar as you'll type it in your audio record, and you can either read it or listen to it or watch videos on it from your mobile phone. And this is something we're looking at. We might even be presenting it later. We can use QR codes to get access, no depth of it, but we're hooking people into the digital archive through their mobile phones. So how does this all fit? Now, this is where I'm just going to tell you about what our thinking is on what systems of the future should be. Everything here is based on something called the cloud. You don't have to worry about what the cloud is. That's a nice IT term. Know that you don't have to install any software, install any hardware. You log into it, and it's accessible. Our approach is that a collection management system should be collection based on the individual institution, separated from any other one. You should have your own digital repository hooked into that so that the inventory and the digital repository are aligned totally, and no limit to what you can store, how much you can store it. Then the shared thing is where you want to actually share things between institutions. And I'll talk a little bit about that. But also sharing common data, access to biographies. By dealing with many archives, museums, we found that there was a common need for biographical information, and we haven't found an electronically accessible one that can be shared from a collection management system. So our approach is to build what we call the ether biographies, the ether places, and the ether this. Now, you see the word ether coming up all the time. It's the name of my company. And what I didn't mention is the word ether is two words stuck together, and the two words are eternal heritage. And I stuck them together and created this word. And the purpose is to look over the very long term. So this is the kind of structure that we're exploring right now. We're piloting some of this. We're building some of this. And we do think it as a very long-term venture. I must say that this is not open source. This is what we've built ourselves here. So what would we do in a community? This is an electronic community. One of them is a national registry of collections. Now, this was mentioned as well to say we need a way that everybody knows what everybody else has got, even at the collection level, so you can find your way in. A register of disposals says who's disposing of things that other people might want. Inter-collection loans, registry of stolen items, and so on. So that was what we saw as the kind of digital community of practice. And finally, just to summarize what I've talked about, three key elements are required in this shift from yourself into becoming a totally digital institution, which is inevitable. You don't have a choice on it. It is the tidal wave that's coming. You're either going to be washed by it or you're going to learn to surf. So, governance, collection management, user experience. Consideration also within the full scope of what we've called the Digital Heritage Body of Knowledge. That is an open document. It's free for anybody. It's just not yet ready to publish. We've had a very big hiccup with it, which we've had to withdraw part of it, but we're busy correcting that right now. Also look at the digital inventories you've got, documentation systems, and also find ways to improve your user experience to make your stuff relevant to a greater number of users. Now, no, 20 minutes is not a long time, and I'm sure I've gone over my 20 minutes, but I've tried to condense into here those three thoughts, of the three things you need to do. You need to change your governance, change your collection management, change your user experience, and you will be on your way to becoming what we now call a digital institution. Thank you. Okay. Yes. I suppose on the policy issue, one of the really big issues that we're confronting is the ethical side and how to deal with the ethics, and especially with one of the projects that we've been on the side of. It hasn't yet started, but it's to do with a Khoisan community who are releasing some of their most innermost practices, and they don't want them released. It's very similar to this discussion yesterday on the people who would only allow males to listen to them and not females. It's a very similar discussion there. I think that policy coming out of that would have to be by dialogue, and I do believe we can come up with best practices of what to include in a policy, like a tick box, to say, how do you address this issue, how do you address that issue? We found the same dealing with some photographic archives that deal with very, very sensitive pictures of people whose descendants are still living, who might not want them to be published on there. So, but under the policy on the oral history, I think that's an open area now. I don't think it's even been addressed. But yet the whole process of the capture of it, the recording of it, the storage of it, and whether it's even embargoed is another issue. The other question I've looked at is, how do you embargo stuff in the digital world? Because many times you're going to get archival material you cannot release for 20 years. In the physical world, you can lock it up. In the digital world, it might be more difficult.
Thank you.